Mungo wondered that he was still capable of surprising himself. There were still strange places in his soul that he had never explored. He took a burning stick from the fire and lit his cigar, then plunged the glowing red of the brand into the black coffee to enhance the taste of the brew. "Well, well, Parson," he murmured aloud, "you have a sharper instinct than I ever gave you credit for." Then he thought of Robin Codrington, trying to consider his feelings objectively and without passion. "Do I love her?" he asked, and the answer was immediate. "I have never loved a woman, and by God's grace I never will." "Do I want her, then?" And again there was no hesitation. "Yes, I want her. I want her badly enough to send anybody who stands in my way to his death." "Why do you want her?" he pondered. "When I have never loved a woman, why do I want this one? She is no longer young, and God knows I have had my pick of 100 more beautiful. Why do I want her?" And he grinned at his own perception. "I want her because she is the only one whom I have never had, and whom I never will have completely." He closed the Bible with a snap and grinned wickedly across the wide river at the dark and silent Mapani forest. "Well done, Parson. You saw it long before I did." The tracks of Lobengula's wagons were clear to follow, even in the worsening light, and Wilson pushed his pace to a canter. Clinton's aged grey was exhausted by 2 weeks of hard trekking. He fell back little by little, until after 5 miles they were loping along with Captain Napier's rear file. The mud thrown up by the hooves ahead speckled Clinton's face as though he was suffering from some strange disease. The Mapani thinned out dramatically ahead of the tiny patrol, and there were low bare hills on either side. "Look at them, Padre," Wilson called to Clinton and gestured at the hills. "There must be hundreds of them." "Women and old men," Clinton grunted. The slopes were scattered with silent, watching figures. "The fighting men will be with the king." The 12 riders cantered on without a check, and the thunder muttered and shook the sky above the low, swirling clouds. Suddenly Wilson raised his right hand high. "Troop, halt!" Clinton's grey stood, head hanging and chest heaving between his knees, and Clinton was as grateful. At his best he was no horseman, and he was unaccustomed to such hard riding. "Reverend Codrington, to the front!" The order was passed back, and Clinton kicked the grey into a plodding walk. At that moment, a squall of rain stung his face like a handful of thrown rock salt, and he wiped it off with the palm of his right hand. "There they are," said Wilson tersely, and through the drizzle, Clinton could make out the stained and ragged canvas tent of a wagon rising above the scrub, not more than 200 paces ahead. "You know what to say, Padre." Wilson's Scots accent seemed even stronger, and was incongruous at this place and in these circumstances. Clinton walked the grey forward another few paces, and then drew a deep breath.
"Lobengula, King of the Matabili, it is me, Chlopi. These men wish you to come to Gubuluwayo to parley with Dakatela and Lodzi. Do you hear me, O King?"
The silence was broken only by the scraping of a wind-blown branch and the rustle of the rain on the brim of Clinton's old hat. Then, quite clearly, he heard the snick of a Martini Henry rifle being loaded, and a young voice asked in whispered Matabili from the scrub near the wagon,
"Must we shoot, Baba?"
A deeper, firmer voice replied in the same language,
"Not yet. Let them come closer, so there can be no mistake."
And then the voices were blotted out by a grumbling roll of thunder overhead, and Clinton backed the grey up.
"It is a trap, Major. There are armed Matabili in ambush about the wagons. I heard them talking." "Do you think the king is there?"
"I would not think so, but what I am sure of is that even now the main impi is circling back between us and the river."
"What makes you think that?"
It is always the Zulu way. The encirclement and then the closing in.
What do you advise, Padre?
Clinton shrugged and smiled. I gave my advice on the bank of the river. He was interrupted by a shouted warning from the rear of a column. It was one of the Americans, his accent unmistakable.
There's a force moving in behind us.
How many?
Wilson shouted back.
Plenty. I can see their plumes.
Troop, about wheel,
Wilson ordered.
At the gallop, for what?
As the horses plunged back down the rough trail, the rain that had been threatening so long burst upon them in an icy silver cascade. It slashed at their faces and stung their eyes and drummed on their oilskins.
This will cover our retreat, Wilson grunted,
and Clinton flogged the grey's neck with the loose end of the reins, for the old horse was falling back again. Through the thick silver lances of falling rain, he caught a glimpse of waving war plumes above the scrub. They were racing in to head off the patrol. At that moment, the grey stumbled, and Clinton was thrown onto his neck.
Gee!
He heard the war chant go up, and he clung desperately to the grey's neck as it plunged to regain its balance.
Come on, Padre!
Somebody yelled, as the other troopers went pounding past him in the mud and the rain. Then his horse was running again. Clinton had lost a stirrup, and he bumped painfully on the wet saddle, clinging to the pommel for a grip. But they were through. There were no shields or plumes in the bush around them, only the twisting streamers of rain and the gloom of gathering night. Are you telling me, Napier, that Major Wilson has deliberately chosen to spend the night on the far bank, despite my direct orders to return before nightfall? Mungo St. John asked. The only light was that of a storm lantern. The rain had washed out the fires. The tarpaulin over the heads of the two officers flogged in the wind, spilling gouts of rainwater over them, and the lantern flame fluttered uncertainly in its glass chimney, lighting Captain Napier's face from below so that he looked like a skull. We got so close to Lobengula, General, within hail of the wagons. Major Wilson considered a retreat would not be justified. In any event, sir, the bush is swarming with the enemy. The patrol has a better chance of surviving the night by stopping in thick bush and waiting for daylight. That is Wilson's estimate, is it? Mungo demanded, putting on a grim expression. Yet inwardly he congratulated himself on such an accurate assessment of the Scotsman's impetuous character.
You must reinforce the patrol, sir. You must send at least one of the Maxims across, now, this very hour.
Listen carefully, Captain, Mungo ordered him. What do you hear? Even over the rain and the wind there was an echo like the sound in a seashell held to the ear. The river, Captain, Mungo told him. The river is spating.
I have just forded it. You can still get across, sir. If you give the order now. If you wait until dawn, it may well be in full flood.
Thank you for your advice, Napier. I will not risk the Maxims.
Sir.
Sir. You can take at least one Maxim off its carriage. We can carry it in a blanket and swim across.
Thank you, Captain. I will send Borrow across with 20 men to reinforce Wilson until morning. And this force will follow, with both Maxims, only when it is light enough to see the ford and make the crossing in safety. General St. John, you are signing the death warrant of those men. Captain Napier, you are overwrought. I shall expect an apology from you when you have recovered yourself.
Clinton sat with his back against the bole of a mapani tree. He had one hand thrust into the front of his sheepskin jacket to hold his travelling Bible out of the rain. He wished above any other creature needs that he had light enough to read it. All around him the rest of the tiny patrol lay stretched out on the muddy earth, bundled up in their rubber ground sheets and oilskins, though Clinton was certain that, like himself, none of them was asleep, nor would any of them sleep that night. Clutching the Bible above his heart, he had the certain prescience of his own death, and he made the astonishing discovery that it had no terrors for him. Once, long ago, before he had discovered how close at hand was God's comfort, he had been afraid, and now the release from fear was a blessed gift. Sitting in darkness, he thought of love, the love of his God and his women and his daughters,
and that was all he would regret leaving behind him. He thought of Robin as he had first seen her, standing on the deck of the American slaver Huron, with her dark hair aflutter on the wind and her green eyes flashing. He remembered her upon the rumpled, sweat-soaked childbed as she struggled to give birth, and he remembered the hot, slippery and totally enchanting feeling of his first infant daughter's body as it slithered from Robin's body into his waiting hands. He remembered the first petulant birth wail, and how beautiful Robin had been as she smiled at him, exhausted and racked and proud. There were other small regrets. One that he would never dandle at grandchild. Another that Robin had never come to love him the same way he loved her. Suddenly, Clinton sat up straighter against the Mopani and inclined his head to listen, peering out into the utter blackness from whence the sound had come. No, it was not really a sound. The only true sound was the rain. It was more like a vibration in the air. Carefully he returned the precious book to his inside pocket. Then he made a trumpet of his bare hands and pressed them to the wet earth, listening intently with his ear to the funnel. The vibration coming up from the ground was that of running feet, horny bare feet, thousands of feet, trotting to the rhythm of an impi on the march. It sounded like the very pulse of the earth. Clinton crawled and groped his way across to where he had last seen Major Wilson lie down under his plaid. There was no glimmering of light under the midnight clouds, and when his fingers touched coarse woven cloth, Clinton asked softly, "Is that you, Major? What is it, Padre?" "They are here, all around us, moving back to get between us and the river." They stood too while the dawn tried vainly to penetrate the low roof of cloud above them. The saddled horses were merely humped shapes, just a little darker than the night around them. They were drawn up in a circle, with the men standing on the inside, rifles resting on the saddles as they peered out into the thick bush that surrounded them, straining for the first glimpse as the grey light settled gently, like a sprinkling of pearl dust upon their dark, wet world. In the centre of the circle of horses, Clinton knelt in the mud. With one hand he held the reins of the grey horse, and with the other he held the Bible to his chest. His calm voice carried clearly to every man in the dark, waiting circle. "Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name." The light grew stronger. They could make out the shape of the nearest bushes. One of the horses, perhaps infected by the tension of the waiting men, whickered and scissored its ears. "Thy will be done, in earth as it is in heaven." Now they all heard what had alarmed the horse. The faint drumming approach from the direction of the river, growing stronger with the dawn light. "For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory." There was the metallic clash of a rifle breech from the silent waiting circle of dismounted men, and half a dozen gruff voices echoed Clinton's quiet, "Amen." Then suddenly someone shouted, "Horses! Those are horses out there!" And a ragged little cheer went up as they recognised the shape of slouch hats bobbing against the sullen grey sky. "Who is it?" Wilson challenged. "Borrow, sir. It's Captain Borrow." "By God, you're welcome," Wilson laughed, as the column of horsemen rode out of the forest into their defensive circle. "Where's General St. John? Where are the Maxims?" The two officers shook hands as Borrow dismounted, but he did not return Wilson's smile. "The general is still on the south bank." Wilson stared at him incredulous, the smile sliding off his face. "I have 20 men, rifles only, no Maxims," Borrow went on. "Well, when will the column cross?" "We had to swim our horses across. By now the river is 10 feet deep." Borrow lowered his voice so as not to alarm the men. "They won't be coming." "Did you make contact with the enemy?" Wilson demanded. "We heard them all around us. They called to each other as we passed, and we heard them keeping pace with us in the forest on either hand." "So they're massed between us and the river, and even if we cut our way to the river, the ford is impassable. Is that it?"
"I'm afraid so, sir."
Wilson took his hat from his head, and against his thigh he beat the raindrops from its brim.
Then he settled it again carefully on his head at a jaunty angle. Then it seems that there is only one direction that we can take, one direction which the Matabili will not expect us to move. He turned back to Borrow. Our orders were to seize the king, and now our very lives depend on it. We must have Lobengula as a hostage. We have to go forward. And that right smartly. He raised his voice. Troop! Mount! Walk, march, trot! They rode closed up, tense and silent. Clinton's old grey had benefited from the night's rest and kept his place in the third file. A young trooper rode at Clinton's right hand.
"What's your name, son?" he asked quietly.
"Dylan, sir. I mean, Reverend." He was smooth-cheeked and fresh-faced.
"How old are you, Dylan?"
18, Reverend." "They are all so young," Clinton thought. "Even Major Alan Wilson himself is barely 30 years of age. If only," he thought, "if only."
"Padre!" Clinton looked up sharply. His attention had been wandering. They had long ago emerged from the thick bush and were now coming up to the same spot from which they had retreated the previous evening. The wagons were still standing abandoned beside the rude track. The tents made pale geometrical oblongs of solid canvas against the dark, wet scrub. Once again, Wilson halted the patrol, and Clinton walked the grey forward.
"Tell them we do not wish to fight," Wilson ordered.
"There is nobody here."
"Try, anyway," Wilson urged. "If the wagons are deserted, then we will ride on until we catch up with the king."
Clinton rode forward, shouting as he went.
"Lobengula, do not be afraid. It is I, Chlopi."
There was no reply, only the flutter of the wind in the torn wagon canvas.
"Warriors of Matabili, children of Mashobani, we do not wish to fight," Clinton called again.
And this time he was answered by a bellowing bull voice, haughty and angry and proud. It came out of the gloom and rain, seeming to emanate from the very air, for there was no man to be seen.
"How, white men, you do not wish to fight, but we do, for our eyes are red and our steel is thirsty."
The last word was blown away on a great gust of sound, and the shrub about them misted over with blue gun smoke, and the air about their heads was torn by a gale of shot. It was 25 years and more since Clinton had stood to receive volleyed gunfire. Yet he could clearly still differentiate between the crack of high-powered rifles and the whistle of ball thrown from ancient muzzle-loaders. And in the storm, the whirr-whirr of beaten pot-legs tumbling as they flew. So that, glancing up, Clinton expected to actually see one come over like a rising pheasant.
"Back! Fall back!" Wilson was shouting, and the horses were all rearing and plunging.
The fire was, most of it, flying overhead.
As always, the Matabili had raised their sights to the maximum. But there must have been 100 or more of them hidden in the shrub, and random bullets were scoring. One of the troopers was hit in both eyes, the bridge of his nose shot away. He was reeling in the saddle, clutching his face, with blood spurting out between his fingers. His number two spurred in to catch him before he fell, and with an arm around his shoulder, led him at a gallop back along the trail. Young Dylan's horse was hit in the neck, and he was thrown in the mud. But he came up with his rifle in his hands, and Clinton yelled at him as he galloped back.
"Cut off your saddlebags! You'll need every round in them, lad!"
Clinton came in for the pickup, but Wilson rode him off like a polo player.
"Your moke's half done, padre. He'll not carry two. Get on with you!"
They tried to make a stand in the thicket where they had spent the night. But the hidden Matabili riflemen crept in so close that four of the horses went down, kicking and struggling, exposing the men who had been standing behind them, firing over their backs, and three of the men were hit. One of them, a young Afrikander from the Cape, had a pot-leg slug shatter the bone above his right elbow. The arm was hanging on a tattered ribbon of flesh, and Clinton used the sleeves of his shirt to make a sling for it.